but I was young and filled with a sense of adventure. So I packed my bags and joined the ranks of thousands of young actors and actresses who pour into New York City each year. I came looking for the American dream. I remember those early years of walking all over the city in search of a job. I often didn't have the fare for a taxi, so it was walking or buses or the subway, uptown and downtown and crosstown, to readings and meetings, sometimes several a day. I came home each night hoping to see the light on the answering machine flashing with the offer of a job. But it rarely flashed, and I frequently felt tremendously insecure. To be an actor, you have to learn to live with fear. Every actor, no matter how good, no matter how seasoned, must face the fear that inevitably arises when you walk onto a stage in front of hundreds of people. Rosalind Russell, the American actress from the 1940s and 50s, once said, "Acting is standing up naked and turning around very slowly." Of course, she was speaking about being emotionally naked, about appearing vulnerable in front of others. Actors have to learn to live with the fear of being vulnerable and to conquer it. I knew that in order to survive pursuing acting as a career, I had to develop a thick skin and the drive to keep going in the face of rejection. This was hard for me, as I'm naturally tender-hearted and sensitive, but I knew that thick skin would provide an armor that would protect me. I had to learn not to take the setbacks to heart and not to take rejection personally. There are often hundreds of actors pursuing just a few roles on each show, and the truth is that you could give the audition of your life and they might still reject you just because of the color of your hair or because you are too short or too tall or too different from how directors envision the character. Even though you know the rejection isn't personal, it often feels personal and it hurts. That's when the thick skin is necessary. But I had to learn to separate from the rejection. It doesn't define who I am. The rejection isn't rejection of me. Acting is what I do. It's not who I am. You can imagine that in those early days, before I had learned to disassociate, I struggled. I can see now that there was still within me a little child who felt the loss of her mother and a painful sense of abandonment. Rejections reopened old wounds that her death had created. And as these hurts re-emerged, I no longer had my father there to offer his quiet words of encouragement and compassion. No matter what your profession, we all face those feelings sometimes. Feelings of unworthiness, feelings of failure, feelings of defeat. But we don't have to stay in those places. I have found that the best remedy to negative self-talk is to try to move myself from a place of fear into a space of love. I start by simply thinking about the people I love. Remember Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music, encouraging the Von Trapp children to think of a few of their favorite things when they were afraid of the storm? Well, that's a version of what I do. I count my blessings, I pray, and I connect to God. Then I'm reminded that God has a plan for my life, even when I do not always see it myself. The time spent in that space of love restores me and gives me courage and joy, and my sense of purpose rises again. I am filled back up to go out into the world and chase my dreams, energized, excited, and full of faith. I spent several years in New York trying to make things happen. I booked some regional theater shows, which were good experiences, but did not pay much. In between shows, I went to acting classes and voice classes and exercise classes, making sure that I was ready. An acting teacher of mine always said that if opportunity knocks, it needs to find you ready and prepared, not taking a nap on the couch. You've got to stay well-tuned in your craft. During my years in Manhattan, I had the good fortune to meet all sorts of wonderful people who respected the struggle of the aspiring actors who populate the city and would do their part to cheer them up. The first celebrity I ever met came up to me one night when I was working as a coat check girl in a fancy Upper West Side restaurant. It was seasonal work, but on a cold winter night, I could pull in some decent tips, making anywhere from 25 cents to a dollar per coat. I would arrive at 5 o'clock to get set up for the night, and most customers would arrive between 7 and 8. I would check people's coats, sit and read for a few hours while they dined, and then retrieve their coats for them around 10 or 11. One night, Regis Philbin walked up and asked me what I was reading. I looked up and recognized his face immediately. I told him the title of my book, and he looked at me with that famous twinkle in his eye, and he said, "Oh, do I detect a bit of an accent?" I laughed and said, "Yes, I'm from Ireland." We chatted for a bit, and then he went off to enjoy dinner with his lovely wife, Joy. He left me a $20 tip, and I will never forget his kindness. Many years later, when I was doing publicity in New York City for Touch by an Angel, I went on a show with Kathy Lee Gifford, and I told him the story. Regis laughed at the end of it and pretended to wipe his brow. "Phew! I was worried for a bit that I'd stiffed you." We soon became friends, and many years later, Mark and I hosted a birthday luncheon for Regis and Joy at our Malibu home. Kathy Lee and I became very dear friends as well. She did a few guest appearances on Touched by an Angel, and I was honored to work with her as an actress. Kathy Lee is a talented, strong woman of faith, and is just lovely to be around. My coat checking soon gave way to some acting work, and I was finally cast off-Broadway at New York's Public Theater and the Roundabout Theater doing Shaw and Ibsen and Shakespeare, wonderful roles in classical plays. I was thrilled to be finally doing what I was trained for and what I loved. It wasn't Broadway yet, but it was interesting quality work, and it paid, supplementing my other part-time gigs. And then one evening, at intermission, the stage manager popped into my room and said, "We have a special guest who wants to meet you." Sir Rex Harrison had been in the audience, and he walked into my dressing room in his impeccably tailored suit. I practically fainted. It was such an honor to meet this movie star, most beloved for his role as Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady. Sir Rex was mounting a production of W. Somerset Maugham's The Circle for Broadway, and he wanted me to come in the following Monday to audition for the role of the ingenue. My heart skipped a beat, and I, of course, said yes. The following Monday, I auditioned and landed the role. This was my first big break. The production also starred Glynis Johns and Stuart Granger, true old-time movie stars who, along with Sir Rex, were in the later stages of their careers. Between them, they had so much experience and wisdom. We toured the country for 3 months and then ended up on Broadway for a 6-month run. I will never forget that first performance on the Broadway stage in New York. Taking my bow at curtain call, I was overcome with emotion. I was grateful to God for guiding me, to my mother who instilled in me the love of theater, to my father who gave me the belief that I had wings and could fly, and to the 3 angels who had helped put me through drama school. Because of all of them and their love and support and belief in me, I saw my dreams come true that night. And that was just the beginning. Appearing on Broadway in The Circle led to the title role in A Woman Named Jackie, which gave me the courage to move to Los Angeles, which of course would eventually lead to me being cast on Touched by an Angel. Nothing gets going from a stationary position. Energy begets energy. One thing leads to another. Each step of my journey opened the door for the next step, which led to Rex Harrison seeing me, which led to my dream. Sometimes we say no to opportunities because they may not be exactly what we're looking for, but the truth is, you never know where things might lead. You've got to stay open and have faith. Life as an actor means living with a degree of uncertainty. It's a life that can create self-doubt and upset the natural urge we all have to feel safe. But we have to be bold and brave, because if we are not, we may miss the opportunity to do really great things. I used to think I needed to have all my ducks lined up in a row before I could step out, that only when I felt certain of success should I move forward. But the truth is, there is no certainty in this life. Pastor Rick Warren once said, "Living by faith isn't living with certainty. It's trusting God in spite of unanswered questions and unresolved doubts." If I had not put my trust in God, I never would have moved to New York or to Los Angeles. Living a life of faith means learning to get our feet wet. When Jesus walked on water, only one disciple asked to join him, Peter. Peter slowly stepped out of the boat and began to do the impossible. When he looked down and began to doubt, Jesus stretched out his hand and encouraged him to trust, to look only at him, and Peter walked on water. I once heard someone say that the only difference between excitement and fear is your attitude. Peter was afraid, but at least he got out of the boat. Our God is not one who is content to keep us in our comfort zone. Jesus challenged his disciples to do more than they thought possible. The disciples weren't cut from theological cloth or raised on supernatural milk, but they were an ounce more devoted than they were afraid, and as a result, did some extraordinary things. Max Lucado. The True Love. There is a faith in loving fiercely the one who is rightfully yours, especially if you've waited years, and especially if part of you never believed that you could deserve this love and beckoning hand held out to you this way. I'm thinking of faith now, and the testaments of loneliness, and what we feel we are worthy of in this world. Years ago in the Hebrides, I remember an old man who walked every morning on the grey stones to the shore of baying seals, who would press his hat to his chest in the blustering salt wind, and say his prayer to the turbulent Jesus hidden in the water. And I think of the story of the storm, and everyone waking, and seeing the distant yet familiar figure far across the water calling to them, and how we are all waiting for that abrupt waking and that calling and that moment when we have to say yes, except it will not come so grandly, so biblically, but more subtly and intimately in the face of the one you know you have to love, so that when we finally step out of the boat toward them, we find everything holds us, and everything confirms our courage, and if you wanted to drown, you could, but you don't, because finally, after all this struggle and all these years, you don't want to anymore. You've simply had enough of drowning, and you want to live, and you want to love, and you will walk across any territory and any darkness, however fluid and however dangerous, to take the one hand you know belongs in yours. David White. The Bible Project. Dream big and dare to fail. Norman Vaughan. When touched by an angel rapt after 9 glorious seasons, my daughter Riley, who was 6 and a half at the time, and I moved back to Los Angeles. I wasn't sure what was to come next, but I was ready for a bit of downtime. I had worked consistently for almost a decade with hardly any time off, and I was tired. I needed some space so I could gather myself, trusting that I would be guided to the next thing. I enrolled Riley in school. We found a lovely, welcoming church, and life began to find a new rhythm. Then, not long after returning to L.A., when I least expected it, I met Mark. We fell in love and knew we wanted to spend the rest of our lives together. So we married and merged our young families together. Mark and I hadn't worked together before, but of course we were in similar fields. He was producing television shows, and at that time had already achieved incredible success with the reality show Survivor. But we both longed for a chance to work on something together and hope to incorporate our faith into that work. I had had the privilege of bringing my faith to my work for all those years untouched by an angel, and I wanted my work life and faith life to be aligned again. As a family, we loved watching movies together. Given our professions, we watched a lot of new movies, but every now and then we would pull out an old classic. One year around Easter, we put on the Ten Commandments and gathered as a family in front of the television set. But the film did not hold our young children's interest like we thought it would. Having been made over 60 years earlier, the film was just too old-fashioned for them. And while it is, of course, one of the classics, the truth is that our kids found it outdated and a bit slow. One morning, a few weeks after this, as we were sitting on our porch having a cup of tea, I mentioned to Mark, "You know, no one has ever done the Bible as a television show. We should do that." Mark looked at me and laughed. "What, the whole thing?" I laughed too. "Well, there is certainly a beginning and an end. We just have to figure out what stories to include in the middle." That conversation was the first step in one of the largest undertakings in our professional careers. It was truly a Herculean task to take a 1,000-page document, beloved and revered by so many people, and bring it to the small screen in a way that honored our faith and glorified God. But what an exciting opportunity to bring these stories to life for a whole new generation. I felt ready to step outside my role as an actor and step into the role of producer. Mark and I spent hours together imagining what it could be. If we were going to pitch this idea, we had to know exactly what it was going to entail. The New Testament felt easier to figure out, as it has a clear narrative beginning with Jesus' birth and ending with his death and resurrection. But the Old Testament is more challenging. It spans so many years and has countless characters. There were obviously some stories we knew we had to incorporate, and then we had a wish list of others we thought might work well on the screen. We soon reached out to a friend of ours, the president of Pepperdine University, and asked him to gather some of the theologians on his staff to be a sounding board about the project. We had an incredible meeting with these bright and faithful minds. They were encouraging, but agreed it would be challenging. They promised to begin praying for us immediately. When we would mention this project to other friends, we wouldn't always get such encouragement. In fact, many of our friends tried to dissuade us from pursuing it. They thought we were nuts. "It's too risky, too big. What if you get it wrong? It could be dangerous, or you might look foolish. You can't win. You will fail. No one cares about the Bible anymore. No one will buy it in Hollywood, and it could be a big, noisy, humiliating flop." We heard their concerns and didn't necessarily disagree with them. We called in prayer and we moved forward in faith. We chose to listen to the positive whisper of encouragement in our hearts rather than the loud negative noises of the outside world. Eventually we found the perfect partners at the History Channel and Hearst. The team at History immediately understood our hope for the scope and scale of the series and they stepped up and partnered with us. We compiled a very large team of Bible consultants and theologians to make sure we brought the story to life accurately. Our intention was to bring the global audience closer to God through these amazing stories. As the writers were shaping the scripts, we began casting in London and Los Angeles and scouting locations and before we knew it, we were set to begin filming in Morocco. Yet one cast member eluded us. We were just weeks from beginning principal photography, and we had not yet cast our most important role, Jesus. To say this made us nervous would be an understatement. He was, after all, our leading man. Obviously, it takes a special actor to portray Jesus, who is so much more than a character or a historical figure. This person must have the special presence to portray someone both human and divine. In addition, he must be ready and willing to take on the role, which would be both daunting and difficult. I was beginning to get worried, and I reached out to all my friends and church prayer circles with an email whose subject line made us all smile. Looking for Jesus, I prayed fervently, asking God to send me the perfect actor to play the Lord, and then to let me know him when he showed up. Then, through a remarkable series of coincidences, I was sent a videotape of an actor reading on camera. It got my attention right away, and the small voice within me told me to follow up. I found out the tape was of the Portuguese actor Diogo Morgado. I called his agent and asked whether he could come in for a meeting. His agent thought I was calling from London and said, "I'm so sorry, but Diogo is out of the country right now." "Where is he?" I asked. "He's in LA," the agent replied. I laughed out loud. "That's where I am," I said with glee. "Can he come by my home office tomorrow?" I asked. "I'll find out," the agent said. Sure enough, he was able to come. I was waiting in the hallway with Mark when we received the call that Diogo had arrived. We have glass on our front door, so we were able to peek out as we watched Diogo open the garden gate and walk up the path to our house. As he approached, a huge monarch butterfly, the size of a small bird, swooped down in front of his face, almost knocking him off his feet. I was sure it was a sign. I started to laugh and turned to Mark, who knew exactly what I was thinking. "There he is, Mark," I said with a smile. "There is our Jesus." And Diogo walked through the door and into our lives. If there had been any doubt in my mind before, it was all gone now. I believed that butterfly was a sign from God. When the Bible finally began airing on the History Channel in the spring of 2013, it exceeded everyone's expectations. The ratings were incredible, with over 100 million people eventually viewing it. Even more special was the personal feedback we began to receive from people around the country. They shared what it was like to watch these impactful stories together as a family, and how it created an opportunity to discuss matters of faith with their kids. People were talking about Jesus around the water cooler. They were talking about the Bible on talk shows and morning shows. It was such a blessing to see how the series was being used to touch people's hearts and remind them of God's love. Shortly thereafter, Mark and I were honored with the chance to speak at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C., to an audience of leaders from all around the world, including the then President of the United States, Barack Obama. We talked about undertaking this project and the significance of bringing the Bible to national television, and shared about our own personal faith, what it felt like to be called the noisiest Christians in Hollywood. We knew that with that title came great risk and great responsibility. I think back to those many conversations with people who tried to convince us we would regret pursuing this project. They had only seen the reasons to be afraid. I am sure that it helped that there were two of us. I'm so thankful I had Mark by my side. I know that pursuing this task together strengthened us in our resolve to move forward, and I think strengthened our marriage and friendship as well. I can't help but feel that God brought us together for such a time as this. Two was better than one, and together with God's help, we knew we could do it. I hereby command you, be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened or dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Joshua 1 verse 9, NRSV. Carried in his arms. God invites us to experience not being in control as an invitation to faith. Henry Nguyen. I've always loved the poem Footprints. My father first shared it with me shortly after my mother's death. It reminded me of the song my mother used to sing to me as I was falling asleep, "You'll Never Walk Alone." Ever since I was a little girl, I've kept a copy of the Footprints poem in credit card size in my wallet, just in case I encounter someone who needs encouragement. Then I share it with them. As I prepared to go to Morocco for the filming of the Bible, I knew I wasn't going to take my normal wallet. I was going to take only the essentials into the desert with me, and I certainly wouldn't need all my membership cards, credit cards, and Starbucks cards. For some reason, I plucked the Footprints card out of my wallet and stuffed it into the little bag that would go with me on the film set. Perhaps someone during the course of shooting might need it. Morocco is beautiful, but the climate can be very challenging, with searing hot sun during the day and sometimes freezing cold temperatures in the evenings. Mark had been with me for the first couple of weeks, but he was in the middle of producing the NBC hit music show The Voice and needed to fly back to LA for the taping. We had a very skilled team in place, so while I would miss him, I knew I could handle things on the set while he was gone. One day we were preparing to film the scene where Abraham walks up the mountain to sacrifice his son Isaac. It's one of the most powerful and dramatic scenes in the Bible. Abraham is so faithful that he's willing to sacrifice his only son, the son that he and Sarah had prayed for, longed for, and that God had finally given to them in their old age. In the scene, we see Abraham trusting God, and even though his heart is breaking, he does not question God and is prepared to do as God asks. Mercifully, an angel of God intervenes and says, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Genesis chapter 22 verse 12, NRSV. And before Abraham's eyes there appears a lamb, the lamb he is now to sacrifice instead of his beloved son. Obviously, we needed a lamb to film this scene, and in the production meetings to prepare for this episode, I had requested two white lambs. I've learned through filming that you always need a backup animal in case the first one doesn't cooperate. We had reached out to some of the local people helping us with the shoot and requested that two white lambs be on the set first thing in the morning. It was all arranged. When I arrived at our location that morning, I saw two lambs and a handler, and yet these were not white lambs. One was a black lamb and one was, let's just say, muddy-colored at best. Through the translator, I did my best to communicate with their handler and asked him why he didn't bring a white lamb. But no matter how much I protested, it didn't change the fact that we did not have a white lamb, and because we were filming in such a remote location, it would likely take several hours for this mistake to be remedied. We did not have several hours. We needed to start filming. "What difference does it make what color the lamb is?" I heard someone ask. But I knew that I wanted the lamb to signify Jesus, who came to be sacrificed for us. Jesus as the Lamb of God. Hans Zimmer had written a beautiful piece of music for the scene with Abraham. The music soared as Abraham and Isaac carried the wood up the hill for the sacrifice. We would play the same music in a later scene as Jesus carried the wood of the cross on which he would be sacrificed. The white lamb was significant and important. I tried to hide it, but inside I was incredibly frustrated, thinking about how this would throw off our filming schedule for the entire day. I walked off the set feeling irritated and alone. I knew if I didn't take a moment to breathe and pray, I was going to cry. I reached into my purse to grab a tissue, and the Footprints poem fell out. I picked it up and began to read it for the 1,000th time. When I got to the end, I smiled and thanked God for this reminder. I hadn't realized when I packed it that I was the one who would need it, that it was there for me, that in the middle of this arid desert, while we were trying to create this series to honor God and his story, I was the one who would need this reminder. I'm here with you. I'm carrying you. You are never alone. With my faith restored, I rejoined the team. We decided that we would film with the muddy-colored lamb and change his color in post-production. It would require coming back to this very location with a white lamb so we could shoot a plate that we would drop into the scene with special effects at a later stage. But at least we had a plan for the day. God helped to keep me calm so that I could make a plan and move forward. I believe that with faith, we can each do the impossible, that life is waiting for us to step up, believe, and do great things. There are always going to be times of anxiety and fear. But when we learn that even in those times, God is with us, it makes it all more tolerable. I've learned that God sometimes calms the storm, but at other times, he lets the storm rage and calms the child. So when you feel like you are drowning in the sea of life, just remember that your lifeguard walks on water. When I stand before God at the end of my life, I would hope that I would not have a single bit of talent left and could say, I used everything you gave me. Irma Bombeck. What do you do when alone with God? Many of us think, talk, or ask. But when alone with God, it's also important to listen. Solitude is the place where you can hear the voice that calls you the beloved, that leads you onto the next page of the adventure, that says, as God said to Jesus early in the Gospels, "This is my Son, the Beloved, with whom I am well pleased." Matthew chapter 3, verse 17. Henry Nguyen. May I dare to dream big, to see possibilities instead of limits, to believe that you, God, can do impossible things with your willing children. Sometimes, God, I get afraid and I'd rather stay safe than do what my heart is calling me to do. Please, Lord, help me to reach out, to get out of the boat, and when I fear that I'm sinking, drowning, look up, see you, and keep walking in faith. Spread love everywhere you go. Let no one ever come to you without leaving happier. Mother Teresa. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. 1 John chapter 4, verse 7, NIV. Chapter 4, Love. What we have once enjoyed, we can never lose. All that we love deeply becomes part of us. Helen Keller. I waited for a long time to have my daughter. I'd always assumed I would have children one day, but never felt the time was right. There was always one more mountain to climb, one more task to accomplish, and of course there was the question of finding the right mate. A couple of years after I first moved to Los Angeles, I began dating a wonderful man. David was a film director, and we went on a blind date set up by a friend of mine. We quickly fell in love. Within a few months, I booked the role of Monica and realized that I would be moving to Utah to film the show. So after we got married, he split his time between Utah and LA. His work was in LA, as well as his lovely 17-year-old daughter, Vanessa. I was already 35 by then, and so I knew that if we were to have children of our own, there was no time to delay. When I found out that I was pregnant, we were both thrilled, and I couldn't wait to tell my other family, the cast and crew, of Touched by an Angel. The day came when I felt ready to share my news. We were filming in a jazz club of all places, and the legendary musician B.B. King was on the set. We had been filming on stage and had a lull in the action, so I told B.B. that I had some special news to share with the group. He said, "Can I play a little intro to get their attention?" And I smiled and said yes. He began to play his guitar, and everyone on set turned to see what was going on. When B.B. finished his musical introduction, I turned back to the cast and crew and said, "Well, thanks, B.B., for that lovely introduction to some wonderful news. I'm so thrilled to share with you all, you who have become my trusted friends and who are truly like family to me, that we are adding one more little angel to the family. I'm pregnant." Everyone cheered as B.B. began to play again. I turned around and he came over and began to play to my tummy. My eyes filled with tears with the special introduction my precious baby was getting to the world. We had quite an interesting time on the series, keeping my pregnancy hidden from viewers. Given our filming schedule, we were expected to shoot until early May, and I was due in June. So there were countless scenes where I was carrying coats or large sun hats or shopping bags or standing behind car doors or a couch. With other kinds of shows, a pregnancy might have been written into the script, but that wasn't an option since I was playing an angel. I chose not to find out whether we were having a boy or a girl, wanting that miraculous surprise at the moment my child was born. But the truth is, when I heard the words, "It's a girl," I realized just how much I'd been hoping for a daughter. And here she was now, in my arms, my own precious, beautiful child. I named her Riley to honor the memory of my mother, Maureen O'Reilly. As I stared down at my sweet baby girl, I felt something happen within me. Tears streamed down my face, both for the miracle that I held in my arms and for the fact that something I so desperately missed was now restored. I cried in that moment for the mother I had lost and the mother I had now become. I had been filled with longing my whole life for this mother-daughter relationship. Now, with Riley's birth, I was given a second chance at that relationship, a relationship I had been missing for more than half of my life. When my mother died, I missed her so much that there was truly a hole in me. The woman I became just grew up around that hole. But it was as if Riley's birth put a W in front of that word and made me whole again. As I held my beautiful baby girl in my arms, I cried tears of joy and healing. There's no question that love is a healer. It began in that hospital room, and in the years since, the love has filled me and touched all the old hurts within me. The love Riley brought to my life has ultimately healed me. She is my special angel, my sweet, beautiful girl, my gift from God. Motherhood opened up a deep well of love in me, love I didn't know I had access to. Becoming a mother also helped my faith grow and deepen because it has given me insight into how much God loves us, His unconditional love, His perfect loving, I finally understood just how much God loves each and every one of us. We are, after all, His special children. The depth of my love for Riley amazes me. And of course, I then marvel at God's love for us. Even though Riley was born by cesarean section, I had to go back to work just a few weeks after her birth. But I was blessed to have had the help and support of so many. I'm thankful for Debbie, our amazing nanny, and everyone on set who made me feel so loved. I couldn't have done it without Linda, my assistant, and the wonderful cast and crew who cared for us. And I was gifted with a schedule that offered some downtime when I could rock and feed and love on my little baby girl in between my time filming. Della was a doting grandmother, and our other regular cast member, John Dye, was the perfect, loving Uncle Johnny. He always called Riley his little lamb. In the embrace of this extended and loving family, Riley grew and blossomed. But sadly, the same cannot be said for my marriage to her dad. My dreams of happily ever after were crushed around the time Riley turned one. We decided to separate, and by the time she turned two, we had divorced. So for many years, it was just the two of us. Riley's dad came to visit her every few weeks, and he was always a good dad and a loving part of her life. But for the day-to-day of it, I was a single mom. Of course, we always had Della by her side. I sometimes had family visits from Ireland when my two half-sisters, Anne and Jacinta, would come on their vacations. Riley always loved the visit from her Irish aunties. But for the most part, it was me, my girl, and our two doggies in our big house in Utah. We were best buddies and so incredibly close. We spent all our time together. Once while shopping in a local mall, someone asked me for an autograph. Riley, who was only four at the time, tugged at my hand and said, "This is my mommy, not TV mommy." Riley and I had such fun together. We had tea parties for her dolls and stuffed animals. We painted pictures. We played hopscotch. And we pretended to be characters in the movies we watched together while curled up on the couch. We swam in the summer, and we built snowmen in the winter. I adored her and passed all my loving and nurturing into my sweet little girl. I knew that Riley was sometimes confused that our family didn't look like a traditional family. I knew that she longed to have a mom and dad and siblings who all lived together as other children do. Her dad and sister Vanessa lived in another state, and though she saw them regularly, it wasn't the same. One day, a little girl at school said that we weren't a real family because it was just the two of us. That upset Riley, and she came home to me in tears. I tried to explain that no matter what, it's love that defines a family. I tried to share how much I felt like Della Reese was my mama, no matter that we came from two different places. I went on to tell Riley about the fact that my family didn't look normal growing up, as I lost my mother when I was 10. So I was a little girl without a mother and with just my dad to raise us. Other family members helped out when they could, but my father really was a single parent again. He learned to braid my long hair and took me shopping for dresses, and he never wanted me to feel the void that was obviously there from missing Mom. Bless him. He strove so hard to make things okay. This story seemed to comfort Riley. She held me tight and said, "It's you and me, Mama. We are a family." I kissed her little head and reassured her, "Yes, baby, and I will love you forever, and I will always be your mommy." I tried to show Riley that she was part of a big family, too, by taking her to Ireland once a year so we could see my siblings and she could play with her many Irish cousins. I wanted her to know what it means to be Irish. I wanted her to know the richness of our culture and beauty of our country, since it is such an integral part of who I consider myself to be. It was a few more years before Riley and I found the family we'd always dreamed of. And when we did, it was so fun and joyful to be welcomed into the family of Burnetts and feel like we all belong together. We blended two families into one, often joking that we were like the Brady Bunch. We all felt so fortunate to have found one another. We weren't a traditional family, so we felt that much more special. We had created something of our own, had taken what could have been just wounds and made something beautiful from them. Love is a healer, a mender. Love has the power to make things whole. The Beatles were right. All you need is love. Love makes a family, not DNA or background. Love. Just love. Simply love. All those years ago, as I was in the midst of my divorce, heartbroken and hurting, I didn't know what was to come. I didn't know then that many years later, I would sit at my Thanksgiving table under the tree in my garden, with my family, my husband and my daughter and my two fine stepsons. And that one year we would also include my ex-husband and his nephew, and my husband's ex-wife and her father, and we would all break bread together, and hold hands, and pray, and be thankful to God together for the blessings we have and for the gift of family, no matter what it looks like. My little angel. Oh, my little angel, you are the flesh and blood of my flesh and my blood. It was God who breathed life into you, and for me, that was his greatest gift of all. And now, as I watch you sleeping, I'm still lost in wonder at the miracle of your birth, and lost for words to describe the blessings you have brought me. Where once my life seemed sometimes empty and futile, now you fill me up and give me reason to live. In a world full of suspicion, dishonesty, and distrust, you, my little angel, are an open book. When I am weak, you give me strength. When I am drifting, you are my anchor. Yesterday I found you weeping over a broken doll, and I wanted to cry as I held you in my arms. And when the day comes when I find you weeping over a broken heart, I know I'll want to die, but I'll still be here to comfort you. Oh, my little angel, whatever befalls you in the years ahead, may the Lord above, who gave you to me, hold you in the hollow of his hand. Phil Coulter. We must let go of the life we have planned so as to accept the one that is waiting for us. Joseph Campbell. Love story. I love you without knowing how, or when, or from where. I love you simply, without problems or pride. I love you in this way because I do not know any other way of loving but this, in which there is no I or you, so intimate that your hand upon my chest is my hand, so intimate that when I fall asleep, your eyes close. Pablo Neruda. The most magical things can have the humblest of beginnings. The magic of my love story with Mark began with my feet in a bucket of water. Not the most glamorous of images, I know, but a girl needs a pedicure every now and then. I had recently moved back to Los Angeles after wrapping 9 seasons of Touched by an Angel. I was being very prayerful and thoughtful about the next steps in my career. I didn't want to plunge ahead without God's gentle guidance. It was a time of great soul searching and of discovering a deeper sense of self, now free of the attention that had rained down on me during the success of Touched by an Angel. For 9 years I had been in the limelight, on countless magazine covers, doing daytime and nighttime talk shows, walking the red carpet, and receiving accolades and awards. I had tried very hard to stay grounded and in gratitude during that time, but the truth is, when it all goes away, it can feel very quiet. The silence can be deafening. In my industry, you can be recognized as one of People magazine's most beautiful people in the world 1 year, and the next year get no public attention at all. If you don't have a strong sense of self or a spiritual life, you can feel adrift and lost. If you don't have a sense of humor, the lack of attention can be painful. And let's face it, if you allow yourself to be defined by what you do, then it raises the question, who are you, when you aren't doing that? Most of us know in our heads that our own sense of self should not be dependent on what we do or how we look. But in real life, that's hard to pull off. I look at my daughter and her friends, and it pains me to see the pressure these girls feel to be thin or beautiful. Our culture puts such an unhealthy emphasis on looking a certain way in order to be loved or valued. I know firsthand how illusory beauty is. Over the years, I appeared on magazine covers, but it wasn't me just showing up with that kind of beauty. There was always a hair and makeup team and a stylist selecting beautiful clothes. But young women don't realize how fake this beauty is. They see it and think they should look that way. I wanted to instill in Riley an appreciation for real beauty. Real beauty is of the heart. It's the glow that lights your face when you're doing something kind. It's the tears you cry in appreciation of someone else's pain. Real beauty is kindness, gratitude, love. If you get too attached to being beautiful on the outside, what happens when that beauty starts to fade? As we naturally age, fear can start to emerge. It can be a painful struggle, and I am not immune to this fear. Fear of letting go of that illusion of beauty. Fear of no longer being valued and accepted. But the real freedom is to be found in letting go of fear. Letting go of the need to look a certain way, to be accepted by the masses. Who you are is perfect. God made you that way. He loves who you're becoming on the inside. This body will fade away. That's what it was made to do. Your heart and spirit will be with you forever. If we can remember this, fear dissolves. Consider Mother Teresa, a woman who aged gracefully and didn't let it slow her down. Her beauty was apparent until the day she died. It glowed in the warmth of her smile as she helped God's people. She was radiant. She emitted a light that you cannot buy in a bottle. She displayed the true beauty of grace, compassion, and love. I knew that this time in Malibu, in between my role as Monica and whatever God had planned for me next, was an important season of growth, a time of letting go of the experience of touch by an angel and the deep connection I had to playing and being Monica, and a time of expanding and deepening my understanding of self and trusting in God for whatever was next. In fact, I discovered a beautiful sense of freedom after we moved back to Malibu and I enrolled Riley in the local grade school. I love being mom at the park and queen of the carpool and living a normal life. I didn't know what was next, but I knew God would guide me. One afternoon, Della came over for lunch, and in her sweet, direct way, she said, "Are you lonely, baby? Isn't it time you trusted your heart to love again?" Well, I felt very happy with my life the way it was. "Oh, I don't know about that. It's hard to meet quality guys," I said, shaking my head. "Well, honey, it's simple. You've got to hand it over. You have to ask God to choose a partner for you." I laughed. It was simple, but I hadn't ever thought of that. I never really thought to ask God to choose for me. Della said, "Well, think about what you want, and you bring that to God. Don't pray it over and over, pray it once, and then just trust." As usual, Della, the great loving and wise woman, was guiding me in a way that I'm so thankful for. And so I took some time to think about what I truly wanted in a man. I would be mindful of those qualities and pay attention. I wanted a man who would be strong and caring, a man to love me and my daughter, and a man who loved God. I wanted a man who was kind and loving and funny. I wanted a good man, an honest man, a man with integrity. I wanted him to be smart and to have his own success so there wouldn't be anything competitive between us. I wanted a man who would make me feel safe. I wanted him to love kids, and I wanted him to share my love of the ocean, of Ireland. To be honest, it was a long list. And then I took a moment and picked up my list and handed it over to God. God, this is what I think I need, but I didn't choose well in the past, so all I ask is that you let me know when he gets here. So, on an ordinary afternoon a few months later, I was getting a pedicure in a salon, and as I sat there with my feet in a bucket of water, wearing a tracksuit with an elastic waistband, for goodness sake, I noticed a man getting his hair cut across the room from me. His back was to me, but I noticed him because he was laughing a lot and generally being pretty noisy. My eyes caught his in the mirror, and my heart started to race. I mean, it was racing. I couldn't ignore it. And I thought, really? Is this happening? I quickly looked away, embarrassed that he'd caught me watching. But I looked up again, and our eyes met again. I felt my cheeks heat. He was so handsome and joyful. Again, I thought, really? Is that him? And I stared back down at my book. I had never reacted this way to seeing someone before. It was a physical reaction, like my body was trying to let me know, something is happening here, pay attention. I couldn't help myself. My eyes were drawn back to the mirror one more time. And yet again, he was looking at me. I vowed not to make that mistake again. A few minutes later, his haircut was finished. He spent a few moments checking out with the receptionist, and he was gone. When my nails were dry, I carefully put on my flip-flops and walked up to the same checkout desk. My curiosity got the best of me. "Excuse me," I said to the receptionist casually, "but do you happen to know the name of the man who just walked out of here?" She looked at me with a smile. "Oh, isn't that funny," she said. "He just asked me who you were." We laughed together, and she told me his name was Mark Burnett. He was local, but originally from the UK. He was divorced with two little kids, and he was a producer of reality TV. I thanked her for letting me know and wondered when he might show back up in my life. He certainly had piqued my interest. A few days later, I got a call from that receptionist. Mark had called the salon and asked if they might give him my number. She, of course, wanted to check with me first before giving out personal information. I said, "Yes, please, give him my number." Shortly after that, she called back again. "Yes," I said, confused. "I'm sorry to bother you again, but he wanted me to ask whether you would say yes if he called and asked you out," the receptionist said with a laugh, probably feeling a bit like a schoolyard go-between stuck back in the seventh grade. I had to admit, I found it kind of adorable that he had her call and ask me that. I told her she could give him my number, of course. I was going to say yes. Well, a few moments later, he called. We went out, and I soon realized that this was it. My love had arrived. Our first date was a Stevie Wonder concert at the House of Blues. Mark and I hit it off immediately. We both came from the same corner of the world, were born the same year, were both divorced with young children of a similar age. He had two boys, I had my little girl. We were both self-made, working in the same field. We lived on the same beach, drove the same car, laughed at the same jokes. It was better than anything I had ever experienced. It was the kind of love I knew could last my entire life. We were married in a small ceremony, presided over by Della, with just our new little family in attendance, and Mark's dad, Archie, and stepmom, Jean. Our oldest boy, James, served as best man, our little boy, Cameron, as ring bearer, and my beautiful Riley was my bridesmaid. It was not just the marriage of two people, but the coming together of a family of five. It felt like it was meant to be. Each child got to keep his or her position in the family. James was still the oldest, Cameron still the youngest, Riley still the only girl.